Hi everyone. Before we get started today, I want to talk to you about our newest partner, BetterHelp. Throughout my own grieving process, I have found therapy to be critical in getting me to the point where I am today, and I truly cannot imagine getting through this past year without it. A lot of the world is still in some sort of quarantine or phased opening, and BetterHelp is a perfect platform for accessing therapy during this time because you can do it from wherever you are. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with a licensed professional therapist, and you can have your first session scheduled in as little as 24 hours, which is huge. I know for a lot of people, you hit a roadblock in starting therapy because there's a pressure to really find the right fit. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. It's really easy to change a counselor if you feel like you want a better fit. The therapist you're matched with is available weekly, but you can send messages anytime through the app and get responses between sessions, which makes such a big difference, especially when you are processing a loss. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and they also have financial aid available, which I love and is one of the reasons that I decided to partner with them. We have a special offer for the Grief Coach listeners where you'll get 10% off your first month at trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. That's trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. You can join over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of experienced professionals. Investing in yourself is so important. If you've listened to any of the previous episodes, you know how much I prioritize doing the work to get through the grief process, and BetterHelp is a wonderful platform to leverage to do so. Go to trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach to get started. Hi everyone, this is Brooke James. Welcome to The Grief Coach. If it is your first time listening, I'm so glad to have you. And if you've listened before, welcome back. Today I have with me Nikisha McLennan and Malachi Bailey, and we are going to talk about the Black experience in America and grief associated with that. Nikisha and Malachi, welcome and thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Brooke.
So if you guys want to introduce yourselves, give the audience a little bit of background to who you are. Nikisha and I worked together and now are close friends, and Malachi and I are new friends through Nikisha. So Nikisha, if you want to go first, please.
Sure. So Nikisha McLennan here. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and pretty much raised in this country. My parents are of Caribbean descent. And together, they decided on my first name. The last name that I carry is the name of my ancestor's slave owner. So I don't know my true last name, my identity, my language. That was erased from my history, and that has a lot to do with the grief that Black people are experiencing right now. It's just one small fraction of that. When I visited Africa a few months ago, Africans asked me, you know, what's your African name? I told them my name's Nikisha, and I said, well, my name's Nikisha. And, you know, my heart broke as I had to say, well, I don't know my African name. But I'm beginning to know more about myself based on my traits that I have and how I can connect that back to my ancestors, but still happy to be part of the world that I'm in right now and hoping to see some change.
Okay, my name is Malachi, last name Bailey. I am a son of the South, grew up in the Deep South, have lived in other areas of the South, even the Northern South. Like right now, I currently live in Baltimore, Maryland. Often people tell us that we are products of our environments. I agree with that. Every one of my thoughts, my fears, my awarenesses, my consciousness, my perceived limitations, my brilliance, my prowess, it's all been shaped by what happened to me from birth until now. I kind of think about my life in sections, like 0 to 18, kind of like the shaping period, then 18 to say 29-ish, more of that forming, that kind of more setting things in place. And then from then on, I would say it's more like the polishing. I describe myself as pretty idealistic, spiritual, Black, fearfully made. So that's me.
Thank you, guys. I'm really glad that you both could be here today to talk about this. Since the protests started, I've wanted to talk about this, wasn't sure how, and was so grateful that Nikisha and I were talking about 2 weeks ago, and she said, you know, you really should do an episode about this, like collective grief in Black America and how that is affecting all facets of life. And then with these protests, what that's bringing up. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing research, but would you do it? And so I'm really glad that you agreed to do this. And Malachi, I'm glad that she brought you along, because I think what I would love to do today is to use this platform to have both of you just share stories, share perspective. The goal of this podcast is to share stories, because I really believe that the more personal stories around grief that people hear, the more empathetic they will be. And so I'm really glad that you can both be here today. So if we can start with a very broad question, and feel free to go where you will with it, but how has your experience of being Black in America manifested in personal and work, wherever you want to go with that? I know that's a broad question.
So since we spend so much time at work, I guess I'll start thinking about that. We often, as Black people, face so many microaggressions and then sometimes just overt aggressions at work. I won't ascribe like intentionality to the offenders. I don't know necessarily that they know that they're doing it, but it is happening. I'm just going to speak about how it makes you feel. I'll give you a few examples just so you get an understanding of what I'm talking about. For example, here's a very small one. Often whenever I'm at work and I work in an environment where Caucasians dominate in terms of numbers, whenever there are two or three of people who look like myself in the hallway discussing any topic, be it work, be it whatever, they always assume, and I'm using they collective to mean the Caucasian people, always assume that we're just shooting the shit, chit-chatting, doing nothing, wasting time, not being productive. And, you know, you're allowed to have non-work conversations at work or go in the hallway to talk about a topic that you may not want to talk about at your desk. You may just want to stretch your legs. You may want to walk and talk. All that's allowed. But somehow they impugn your motives when you're doing it. And you're Black. And they don't even, I don't necessarily know, and I hate to keep saying they, I don't even necessarily know that there is an understanding of what it is they are communicating, but they communicate a lack of seriousness about whatever it is you have going on, because clearly whatever you're talking about couldn't be important. Now, I have never once stepped outside the hallway and saw two or three any other race people talking together and, you know, thought that, oh, I should comment on, oh, it must be a party going out here. There's no, because I don't care. I don't concern myself with what they're doing, which is I don't want to go on a tangent, that's a cultural difference as well. Like, Black people in general have been taught, and this is not by accident, this is about survival, and it's been inbred in you since the first people were stolen and put on ships. Mind your business. And my perception as a Black man is, and working in my environment, that, say for like white people, are not told that when they grow up, but we are told this. Because I perceive them, and this is going to be generalized, they're just kind of concerned, read nosy, about everybody else. So that's just a small example of things that you might face in the work environment. I can give you another one. Like, people are fascinated by my person. So, oh, what are those? Is that a wig? One time a person at work asked me, did I have on a wig? Because I have dreadlocks, I have locks. And I guess they thought that, I don't know what they thought, but you know, I wasn't specifically offended about them saying I have a wig. But a wig is just absolutely, I mean, it's culturally insensitive. It's almost ridiculous to think that I have on a wig. Have you never seen locks on a person? They're fascinated, they're like, oh, can I touch it? Like, I am not a circus animal. You can go pet somebody at the zoo, but what is that about? Because I have never once walked up to another person and thought, oh, can I touch your hair? That's never crossed my mind. But these are things, and although these things may seem small and innocent, they are not. And I mean, they just create an environment that make it hard to work in a way. It makes it difficult to work because I'm always having to build up defenses for what other nonsense I'm going to have to deal with later. Like first I'm playing my head, you think I'm out here partying. It's not just the way that they engage you. It's how discipline and how treatment is meted out because of who you are. I can think of situations where the way the person handled the situation, because it was me, by the way, I think it might be relevant to note, I am the only Black person in my office. I don't know if that's relevant. I think it is. That the way they handled it was just completely like OD, over the top, unnecessary, when you could have just come to me, spoken to me about a thing, that we could have cleared it up and moved on. But they make things that are small, very large. And so it gives you a feeling of like someone is zeroing in on you and always targeting your behavior. And it's easy to stand out because I'm the only person with this gorgeous melanin flowing in my skin. So it's a little, you know, so it makes you feel put on the spot. I think I'll stop there and let Nikisha jump in.
Yes, I can relate a lot to what you mentioned, Malachi. And firstly, Brooke, I want to thank you for what you're doing here. I think it's really important. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to leverage your platform to get our message out in a way that only we can, truly. I also want to just say for your listeners that I personally would not have been a part of this podcast had it not been for the work that Brooke had already been doing before it was trendy for the broader community of white people to support the Black Lives Matter movement. Brooke pulled me in one day, somewhere deep in my borough of Brooklyn, to support Black children in my neighborhood who had parents that were incarcerated and support them in a very meaningful way, in a way that even I wasn't doing for my own community. That was very humbling. And so I say to you, Brooke, I think that was very wonderful. And, you know, I spoke to a couple of my colleagues over the past few weeks, and a lot of us agree that, you know, it's not our place to spoon feed non-Black people in terms of what our Black experience is. We all agree that, hey, if other people want to meet us halfway, do a little bit of research and then ask questions about what they've already found out for themselves, then cool. We can start the discussion there, but what we're not going to do is package our Black experience up into a neat list of bullet points to then just hand over, because that's very dismissive and quite lazy. So thank you for meeting us halfway, Brooke.
You're welcome. And again, thank you so much to both of you for being here and sharing your perspective.
So my perspective on how racially induced grief has infiltrated my work and life, similar to Malachi, I have definitely experienced in my work life the hesitation among even Black colleagues to, as we say, congregate for too long in the halls. All too often, I met with other Black colleagues, if we just kind of chit-chat for a couple of seconds in the halls or whatever, about, I don't know, nothing, you know? There's a sense of anxiety that you feel in the group. Someone will and always inevitably say, hey, I think we've been congregating too long, we're getting stares, we're going to have to break up and just go back to our seats and get back to work before people start wondering what we're talking about. And that is rooted in something. I want to really bring home the fact that a lot of what we see right now that we've opened our eyes to in America, we've taken off the rose-colored glasses and we're seeing America for what it is. Is rooted in slavery. It is. And I'm not going to be the person that blames everything on it, but there's so much about the Black American experience that is rooted in slavery. And I'll give you an example. Back on the plantation, Blacks were not allowed to congregate. Why? Because the slave owners feared retaliation, and for good reason, right? So if we were seen congregating, you know, the question was, the overseer would be like, what the hell are you doing? Someone would get whipped on their back. You know, you're supposed to get back to work. That's where that came from. We saw it again after slavery. 2 years after slavery, it took 2 years after slavery for us to get the right to vote. While we were slaves, we did not have the right to vote. And once we did get the right to vote, it was still a fight. There was still so much voter suppression. There was still so many white people telling black people that if they see them at the polls, they will kill them. So coming together in any form or fashion, unification in any form or fashion, be it just shooting the shit, having the conversation, or voting, has historically been seen as a threat. And so what that's created, what that kind of historical mindset has created, it's created an implicit bias, right? So stereotypes about black people that even some of our allies may just kind of unconsciously have. They may wonder, why are these black people talking? And they don't even understand why they feel the way they do. It's become our nature now to be afraid to congregate and also be afraid of people who are congregating. And it's just been handed down from generation to generation.
Do you think that what just came to my mind immediately was what has been some people's reaction to the protests, like the people who speak negatively about it?
Yeah, we can look back at the Black Panthers who were armed and trying to protect their community, much like many white communities in the South where guns are fine to own and you can have it to protect your community. It became a thing, a huge thing when black people did it. And there's always been this kind of cloud of fear in parts of the white community. I'm not going to say all of it, that white people, I'm just going to say that a group of white people or whatever, maybe the powers that be, have always been afraid of retaliation. They know what they've done. They know what they've supported. You know who they are, Brooke. They, right? Air quotes. Yeah. They've always been afraid. And the only way to keep black people from really retaliating is to A, keep us broken up, you know, prevent us from being unified in any form or fashion, and including protests. So there's always going to be this battle between good and evil. That's just been what life on earth has been for anyone. And that's what we're seeing. And it is hard to understand why even the debate, when things just make sense that people should have basic human rights, but there's some people that just don't agree with that because they're afraid of, you know, losing power or being cut out of maybe the cushy life that they've been afforded due to what their privilege has afforded them. So that's just one small fragment, right? One iota of kind of what impacts grief. Because think about it, me and Malachi's career has spanned over 16 years. And for 16 years, we've dealt with people wondering about or asking us dumb questions about our hair. Me being afraid to wear my hair a certain way at work because I know I can't wear my hair out in its natural form at an interview because that may come across as militant or something. You know, I may look like some Black Panther power sister, and that may resonate in some negative way to the interviewer. Crazy hair, something like that. But if a white woman wears her hair just normal, that's how her hair grows out of her scalp. Mine grows a certain way too. And why is it that I have to fry it and dye it and lean it down and grease it and do all these things to make it look more tame so that I can just get a job and pay my bills?
And then that's time that you can't spend doing something else.
I could be drinking water and minding my business. I could be doing that, but I'm like spending all night trying to fix my hair. That's just one small fragment, you know, and after, you know, that multiply that by 16, 17 years, it begins to wear on you, right? And then add into that seeing Rodney King get beat down, seeing Sean Bell get gunned down in Queens, seeing Philando Castile get killed on camera, and seeing their perpetrators just walk scot-free. Amadou Diallo get just violently disrespected in the police precinct, and those perpetrators walk free. It begins to wear on you. And those people are not my direct family, but they're kin to me. They're kin to me. They're kin to Malachi, and it hurts. Fast forward to Breonna Taylor, right? To Ahmaud, to George Floyd, right? Emmett Till, who I never knew. He died long before I was born. My heart still aches. I feel it in my womb. Like, it hurts. I break every time. I die a little bit every time I see that. And Brooke, you and I spoke a little bit about what the killing of Black men is meant to do to Black women. We spoke a little bit about that. And for your listeners, I'll just briefly share what that was meant to be. Back on the plantation during slavery, there was a man by the name of Willie Lynch who became like this, I don't know, some kind of guru in terms of like how to make a slave. Like he literally wrote like a little handbook about it, a little letter. And that became like the guidelines for how to break down someone mentally so that you can control them. He had all kinds of things in this manifesto. One is if you want to create, you know, Africans came over here, we had strong warrior spirits. They came from warrior tribes, the Zulu tribe, the Oyas, the Ashanti, the Akan, right? All these tribes, and they were fearless warriors, and they had that warrior spirit. It came with them across the ocean. It lives in Black people today. That's how we're not like all plumb crazy, because it lives in us. But slave owners realized that they had to break that spirit. How do you do that? Well, there's always somebody timid out the group. So Willie said, how about you breed one timid slave with another? They'll make a timid slave. And he found out that, you know, hey, if you can breed vicious pit bulls and tame pit bulls, you can do that with humans. Let's do that. It was a social experiment. He did that. You want a very strong, sturdy slave, you know, breed two strong, sturdy slaves together, right? So he did that because these behaviors and traits are passed down through the DNA. He also said, if you want to further break down that warrior spirit, not just wait for breeding, right, to happen, because that takes a while, right, to make a baby and all that, you can beat or kill a female slave's husband or man, whatever, in front of her and her family, beat him bloody, beat him while she's tied up and cannot help him. Make him look really, really helpless in front of her because she looks to him as his guardian. The Black man is my guardian. I still look at him that way, but I also know that he has been broken down over the years. And because Willie came up with some kind of idea to break down the guardians, now our men are forced to what we call code switch. And code switching is being yourself outside of work, just being your Black self. You know, we got our own way of speaking and talking and acting and moving around. And, you know, our voices are even different. Black women's voices have a little bit more velvet-like depth to it. You know, you kind of hear, you don't have to see a Black woman before you can just hear her and know that there's a certain bass that comes in her voice and you know it's a Black woman. The same for a Black man. It's just the way they're made. They kind of carry like heavier tones in their voice. Well, that is seen in the corporate world, and many Black men know this, as aggressive, as a threat. So they have to raise their voice a couple of octaves. How emasculating is that? They have to raise their voice a couple of octaves just so they don't sound threatening, right? That's been passed down from that man that was whooped on the tree in front of his woman. Now, what does his woman think? His woman doesn't respect him as much, because she's like, damn, what happened to my warrior? On the flip side, Willie said, you should rape the woman in front of her husband and tie him up. And she needs to see that he cannot help her, mm-hmm. right? So I'm gonna take that piece right there, and I'm gonna fast forward to 2019. I was sitting with a group of Black junior colleagues at my place of work. I work for a Big Four consulting firm, and anyone who knows Big Four consulting firm is not for the faint of heart. So it's already hard working there just for anybody. But then being Black on top of that is even harder. There's a female at the table, also a couple of Black males, and the female said that there's a white woman who said something who kind of, I guess, posed a microaggression towards her. It was really offensive, whatever she said. I can't even remember what it was. And she handled the situation herself. She spoke up for herself and told the woman she was out of line. What broke my heart, honestly, was to hear one of the Black men that were at the table. He said, well, she can take care of herself. I didn't say anything. You know, I just kind of sat back because I knew she had it. She could fight for herself. And my problem with that is that came from back on the plantation, right? There's a reason why she felt like she had to stick up for herself, because she didn't feel as though someone else was going to stick up for her. So Black women have to be a little bit more scrappy. They were bred to be a little bit more scrappy because they're not protected by the men around them. And not that we're damsels in distress, but we should be able to feel protection from somewhere. We're not protected from the law. If we're not protected from other men around us, if we're not protected by the men within our own community, we naturally will become, like, evolve and just become a little bit stronger and more independent. So it broke my heart that he just kind of left her out there in the wind on her own to fend for herself, and that he didn't. It would have been nice to see him also speak up and say, hey, I also agree with that. You shouldn't. I agree with her with whatever she just said in response. Well, I also agree that what you said was wrong. Rather than kind of cower, put his head down and kind of get back to work. But, you know, I don't really fault him, because this is what America has made the Black people. But there's always going to be that spirit within us that fights against it. And that's what, you know, keeps us clinging on to where we are now. So all of that, those couple of things I've mentioned are just fragments of what the Black experience historically has been inside and outside of work, especially seeing Black men and women get killed on TV. It's hard. It was happening all along, but now we're seeing it in social media. It's been happening for ages. But that does feel like terrorism in a way, right? It does feel like there's domestic terrorism happening right now. And I've done a small bit of research on this, and it says that 30% of people who survive terrorist attacks develop PTSD within a month. Times that by an entire generation of people, generations of people. Victims are unlikely to forget what happened, which is the case, but they do tend to recover in about 3 months. Those who survive terrorist attacks, and some don't heal for decades. What we're dealing with is a group of people who've had post-traumatic stress disorder from the moment our ancestors were even taken from Africa, and all of the things that ensued between then and now that still continue to reveal themselves. It's just trauma happening over and over and over again, and we never even get a chance to recover. They say you usually recover in about 3 months, but when do we even get a three-month break? We've been protesting since George Floyd got killed, and there have been multiple other people, Black people, that have been lynched since then. There's only been 20 days worth of protests. There have been several other Black people that have been killed that we know about. One man was found hanging in a tree. When do we get this chance to recover? It lives with me. I don't really have the words to describe the undercurrent of sadness and confusion that's ever present as a heavy burden in my life. We as Black people were forced to suppress how we feel about it, which is about 70% of our time, because that's how much time we spend at work every week, because no one really wants to talk about that. It's only now that we're having an open dialogue about that. So many generations before me have just carried this sadness, and now it's coming up And not only am I upset about the killings, I'm upset about all the other microaggressions I get. You know, being constantly cut off by Indian coworkers just don't respect anything. The fact that I have a voice to speak. I have some wonderful Indian friends who I count as brothers and sisters, but there's also a solid population that I work with and have worked with that have no regard for people of darker complexion. And it's really sad.
That is true. I just want to pick up on that last point. There is such a devaluing of Blackness that it does not matter what the other races are. Somehow, many people have been communicated, have received the message that you can devalue Blackness, Black thoughts, Black voices, Black ideas, etc. And so just in kind of relating it back to the original question about how it makes you feel in your life, it is like it's constant indignities. Every day, all day, it is my having to walk around and think about how I'm going to make other people feel before I think about how I'm feeling. I got to make sure that I'm not too close because I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I have to endure the indignity of seeing you grab your purse like I can't afford this little cheap purse you got. It is a constant barrage of just nonstop, almost harassment. But I would even go further and say that the racism that has infected America from its foundation really is like covert and overt violence with which I contend in every moment of every day. It is not comfortable. It is ever present. And it's the type of thing wherein when you do have an opportunity to explain it to someone, or if someone has curiosity, they begin to gaslight you as well, because that's also a part of it. They deny your feelings because, of course, your Black mouth can't explain your Black thoughts and your Black feelings, because nobody has to respect it, because we've already been taught to devalue whatever you say. But if I do choose to just entertain you for the hell of it, then I get to tell you that, nah, that's not what's really going on, or you've been a little too sensitive. So it's you add the insult to the continual injuries that haven't healed since August 20th of 1619. And you continue to tell me that, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm being dramatic, it's just, like I said, it's just a continual feeling of, I don't want to go so far as to say worthlessness, but it is a feeling of, it's like you're sort of drowning. You're always trying to dog paddle, just to keep your head above the water, because that is what racism feels like. It envelops you. It chokes you. Its goal is to submerge you, but you have to constantly battle against it. So I reach back on my foundations, my spirituality, the strength of the ancestors, the prayers that your great-great-great-grandmama laid up many years in advance, because she believed there'd be a day when maybe I wouldn't have to endure everything she had to endure. Like, I don't have a brand on my neck, but perhaps she did. The racism thing is like just a constant barrage of, it's like getting beat up all the time.
Do you find in the past 20 days since the protests have started, there's been much more attention paid to racism in this country than ever before, an open dialogue about it? Malachi, what you said about the microaggressions and the gaslighting, like, I would assume in the past 20 days, people have said stuff to you, but of just any gaslighting you've experienced in this awakening.
So a couple of days after the George Floyd video really began to make its rounds, one of my coworkers, who is white, texted me early one morning to say, oh man, isn't it so terrible how they're burning down buildings and how things are being looted and destroyed? And how would you feel if you owned a business and people came and destroyed it? And you know, that line of talk. And I was indignant when I received the message, because I don't necessarily think people are always aware. I think I've already said this. They're not always aware of what that the way they are couching something is really offensive and is like another indignity that I'm having to endure. So I just tried to redirect him and say, well, people are kind of over this whole police continuing to murder people without any consequence and with reckless abandon and, you know, that kind of thing. His conversation continued to be about buildings and Target. My conversation continued to be about humanity, lives, and how that this is not just about George Floyd. He was a catalyst. His death was a catalyst. But this has been going on since time immemorial, and how people have continued to be fed up. So I just want to mention that piece. And I guess that's not so much gaslighting as it is just a total missing of what is valid and what is important. Because the buildings are, it's unfortunate that somebody's going to have to file paperwork for insurance and rebuild it and whatever. And that's awful, because for a few weeks, I won't be able to go and buy Fruit of the Loom draws at that Target. However, I can't order them online. And also, I can't bring back the hundreds and thousands of people who will continue to be murdered at the hands of the police and other citizens who feel empowered to devalue Black lives as well. And for me, and I believe I can probably speak for the majority of Black people, we feel that is significantly, I don't even want to say more important, because it's not even in the same universe of relevance when it comes to their humanity and some brick and mortar that we can restart. I forgot what the first thing was you mentioned.
I was just curious of if you have white friends, white colleagues, not necessarily even white, non-Black friends or colleagues who in the past 20 days, when they are trying to talk about everything with you, if when people ask questions and then ask about your experience, have you experienced then people are gaslighting you when? So like they're trying to be helpful and like educate themselves and then, you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm asking it right.
It feels similar to gaslighting when people everywhere, non-Black people, ask the question, why now? Like, why, you know, I get that, you know, this has been happening for a while and I've been numb to it and everything, but all of a sudden, Floyd's death was very impactful. I mean, it wasn't like he was, you know, famous or anything. Like, what about him? And that in and of itself says, what was so significant about him that we should care so much? There's these questions are coming from people who mean well, and they're curious. I get the genuine curiosity about why Floyd, in a matter of weeks, like Ahmaud Arbery died in February, okay? George Floyd died far more recently. And so I get the curiosity about what's the significance of him, but it's just it's very important to be careful about asking that question, especially as a non-Black person, because it says, why does Floyd's death matter? That's what that question really says underneath. If you scratch the surface and really truly understand what it says, and you know, you can mean well, but it's very important to not ask that and ask yourself that question. You know, before the protests, we've heard from everywhere people that have some sort of consciousness about this. Say, you know, this quarantine is all about going indoors. It's about going inward and looking at yourself and taking time and blah, blah, blah. And it still is. This protest is also about that. It's about understanding, especially what this word anti-racist means. I'm actually a little bit worried about how the definition has taken shape over the past few weeks. It's still, the definition doesn't feel solid to me. We know what a racist is, but I think we have, America has yet to define and truly understand what an anti-racist is. Right now, it just sounds as though it's being defined as speaking up when you see something wrong, shaking your finger at other people when they do something wrong, supporting Black businesses, these kind of things. But where in that does the anti-racist, the so-called ally, look within themselves and stop looking outside and look within, which is what this period in time is asking us to do, right? Just based on the quarantine alone, you're just asked to just be look at yourself and see where you personally should be making some changes in how you think and how you speak to people, right? That's critical. I don't see that as yet. And over the past few weeks, there's been some emotional just ongoings for me. Since Floyd's death, on the day of his funeral, I actually got news that my grandmother passed. Now that is news that I could have handled normally outside of a global pandemic and outside of watching our modern day Emmett Till get funeralized. But that became a burden a little bit too heavy to bear, right? I, as a Black person, carry an extra burden, which makes the death of my grandmother of natural causes too hard to bear. I should be able to take a few days off of work and come back. Now I need extra time because I've got to process so much more than just that. So much more than just that. And that is a fraction. That is a fraction. I was supposed to be at my grandmother's funeral today. I could not go because someone who had wronged me in the most horrific way in my life, my rapist, was at the funeral. My father. That's something I lived with for a very long time. And normally I just get through life, but I've got this cloud hanging over me, this racism that I'm asked to talk about all the time, and I'm hearing the wrong things from people at the same time. I couldn't go to her funeral. That was his mother. I chose to go vote instead, to do something positive instead of that. These are the burdens that people, they have normal burdens that other people carry, but then on top of that, being Black, I'm dealing with that too. We have a heavy load. And I don't know what the true answer is to get people to really understand and respect what's been going on. I've had an Indian coworker years ago came to me and very proudly pronounced that she was not going to give her Black resource, it was someone working for her, time off. He requested time off to go process his grief around Philando Castile's death, murder. And I understood why. It hurt to see that. It hurt to see that. Me and my Black friends talked about that. It was so sad to watch. And I understood why he needed the time off. She said she thought he was bullshitting and he didn't need the time off and he's just being lazy and blah, 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 blah. And she told me, a Black person, she's telling me this, that she didn't give him the time off and why and how she thinks is just nonsense. And I did explain to her that he probably fears for his life all the time, every time he sees flashing lights, and it could have been him. He's a regular guy, just like Philando. These are not people just off in some other planet. These are everyday people, and any one of us are fair game. She still didn't care, but also, who knows whatever other everyday problems this guy has. To be so dismissive about something like this is just like, it really just says to you at all times, nothing you have going on for you matters. I expect you to remain the strong, stoic Black person that you have always been. I expect you to still come to work and not grieve the loss of your kin, right? Your brethren. I expect you to just show up and show out at all times. And so that in and of itself feels gaslighting. Gaslighting doesn't have to happen right now in this moment. We face it inherently, you know, just by existing.
Oh, can I comment on your coworker? Mm-hmm. Your coworker was grieving in the same way that President Obama commented about Trayvon Martin when he said, he could have been my child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter about social class, doesn't matter about socioeconomic status. Any of us are susceptible to these horrific outcomes because of the inherent institutional racism that exists in this, is systemic as well, that exists in this country. And so that is why, it's not that I ever played basketball with Mr. Castile, but I could have. Mm-hmm. It could be my brother. It could be me. It could be my nephew, my cousin. So everyone, you feel like kinship, because you cannot, you remember those old cop shows where they used to have the people on the board and the four squares and they separate stuff out? There's no separate, I can't categorize the pattern. There's no pattern of practice. The only commonality is black. And that is why it's so scary and has to stop.
It's not to say that black people or just people in general don't care if we saw this happen to a white woman or a Mexican person, which, geez, my heart goes out to Mexicans too, because this country is not good to them. But when you see a disproportionate amount happen on the scale at which it's happened, it happens to us, meaning the slayings of black people from the history, from the beginning of the history of time in this country, that's when it hurts even more. This was every now and again. I don't think that, you know, me and my friends would feel this heavy weight all over us. I've got black colleagues from Africa where all they know is black excellence, okay? They look around, every billboard has black people all over it. Everybody's father is a doctor, everybody's mother is a lawyer. Every president they've ever had is black. Us in black America, we've seen a black president once. So we get really excited about that. And I had a Nigerian colleague mention to me that she didn't understand why black people were the way they were and why they felt so downtrodden. But it's PTSD, right? Like, you can't really expect a people to rise above all this and just go for it and just be go-getters and everybody just turns out to be Oprah just because things are now more accessible than they were in the past. We're starting from a place where mentally so many of us are broken down, and it took so much to get out of this. It took so much to show up where at any job and be great and try to suppress and compartmentalize all the stuff that I go through on a day-to-day basis just so I can just be great. And, you know, it's just really frustrating to deal with the lack of empathy that exists and to see the slayings that still persist even in this time. Again, it's not that black people don't care about when these things happen to other people, but seeing it time and time again to one group of people, it wears on you. It wears on you. And even my Nigerian coworker, she said she hadn't even seen the video. She hadn't even seen the video. And for some reason, for 2 weeks straight, she just was in a state of depression. That's this heavy energy that's just all over. Everyone's feeling it, you know? And now it seems like, for the first time in the world, in our lifetime anyway, other people that really haven't seen and felt what we have are actually starting to feel that heaviness that we carry for a long time. And we still smile, we still dance, we still carry on because that's just what we do. But it's the first time that other people of other races are starting to begin to feel just a little bit of what we carry for generations.
And I'm curious if you could share any examples, because I like to do this on this podcast, of things that people think are helpful to say that are not, because it comes from a good place. And I went through it of like, I think I said to you, I was like, this feels like an absolutely ridiculous question to ask you, but like, how are you doing? Like, because right. Feels like saying nothing seems also silly, but you know, like what are some examples of things that you I'm sure you have several of things people say that they think are helpful and they're not.
You know, it's funny, I was just actually talking to a friend about this last night. When all of this first started, all of this being the protest, the direction was kind of put out there, like, check in on your black friends, find out if they're okay. Like, that was the question. So all the white people got to work and they started texting everybody saying, hey, are you okay? I'm like, damn, who told you to ask that question? No, I'm not okay. Like, what you think? But it's funny because when a black person asks me that question, it doesn't hurt as much. So it's almost like I know where that question's coming from. I know that they truly understand and they're really asking me if I'm okay. Whereas when some white people who we've never talked about this kind of stuff before, you've never been down for the cause. I had never seen you, heard you ever utter anything remotely within the galaxy of Black Lives Matter. And now you're asking me if I'm okay. You're only doing that because somebody asked you to. I physically respond to that question in two different ways based on who it's coming from. Brooke, you can ask me that question because I know you already about that life. So like, I get it. So some things that are not okay. I mean, well, here's one thing. My friend, his white coworker, he's actually cool with the guy. They both have kids. And my friend has a young Black daughter. His friend has two young white children. And he calls him and he's like, boo-hoo and sobbing. He's like, oh, you know, I didn't understand your experience as a Black man. I'm so sorry. Next time you come out to New Jersey, can you bring your daughter? I want my daughters to experience what it's like to have a Black friend. And they're like, that's not what you do. It doesn't happen that way. My kid is not like your white children's like token Black friend. It needs to happen organically. And when I talk about this looking inward, going back to that, it's like, well, that man should ask himself why his kids don't have a Black friend to begin with. Let's start there. And no shade, but just, you know, do the work, think about it, and stop asking Black people to make it easy for you to just, like, get over this thing. Another thing that I think is not okay to say Black people as they grieve during this time, and we've been grieving for a while. We're going to be grieving for way longer, even when the protests stop. So don't think it's okay to ask these things once the protest ends, but don't tell us that you're afraid to say the wrong thing. That inadvertently asks us like to tell you what to say, and that's not fair, right? It's okay to think about what you want to say and then say it, but really think about it. It takes work. This whole dialogue takes work. The second thing is, you know, I hope things change soon. I've heard this plenty of times over the past few weeks, and it's really messed up. And Brooke, I know you can relate. This is very equivalent to, I'm sorry for your loss. You know, tell us what you're doing to make a change. Tell us about the changes that you're making in your life to impact things. Don't tell us that you hope things change soon. Like, damn, that sucks, you know? I've heard it and it's very triggering and it's very, I get heated. Just don't say that to me. Don't say anything. Don't say anything if you don't know what to say. And then the final thing I'd say is don't expect things to be normal. Don't kind of act like things are normal because they're not. And that's the problem. As a trauma survivor myself, as a Black person, as a woman, I know this for a fact that trauma survivors need truth and transparency. There is like a lifetime of avoiding the elephant in the room that happens as a result of trauma. And it's usually the trauma survivor that pretends the elephant doesn't exist in the room, even though they're keenly aware of it. But just to go along, to get along, they engage in this nonverbal dialogue of pretending that elephant does not exist. Speak to it. Say its name, right? And then move through it, not over it, not around it, not across it. That doesn't work. So let's not pretend that things are normal. I think that just being a little bit more empathetic to Black people at this time, a lot of Black people are just going through all kinds of things right now. It's taken me, before I took a little time off from work, it was taking me hours to complete a task that should only take me 30 minutes. Because my mind was scrambled. And I think that's that whole surreal kind of like spaced out thing that you go through when you're grieving. You just feel disconnected from yourself. Everything's a blur. You literally have no idea what transpired in the last 3 hours, like 3 hours ago. And you're not taking care of yourself. So, you know, it's important just to, I'm not asking for anybody to handle Black people like they're some delicate little petals. We've already proved we're not. But just be a little bit more understanding that we might be going through some things mentally right now that are showing up in the way we come to work. We're still wanting to come to work. We're still wanting to be our best, but it's a little hard because we're a little disconnected mentally right now. So that's what I have to say about that.
And I would just posit that anything that is short of empathy about the very real fragile mortality that Black people deal with in this country and their related stress, trauma to existing falls short. So what am I saying? If you come to me when these situations happen, like the coworker I mentioned earlier, and you're talking about, oh man, people burning down buildings, that is not empathy for my feeling of fear whenever the cops are behind me or to my left or to my right. When these situations happen and there's a video and then I hear people say things like, well, we don't know what happened before, we don't know what happened after, or didn't he steal some bubble gum when he was 7 from the corner store? Because they gotta, you know, go back and bring in things that aren't related to the moment. These are the things that fall short of what should be the focus, which is how can we stop Black people from being murdered? Larger question, how can Black people feel as safe as white people in America? How can I walk up to the cops, cuss them out, slap shit out of them, and not be feared for my life? Because that can't happen. But it could happen if I was white. I could take a car and ram it into your car and still walk away and not get murdered. So whenever we can get parity, that we can just be equal, then things will be okay. If your conversation is not geared toward how to bring about that equity, I am not interested in any of the tertiary things you want to discuss, because I'm all about my humanity and everybody being treated fairly. So that's all I want to say about what are the wrong things. Anything that's not related to empathy for the current situation, all your distractions would be the wrong things.
Thank you. I think all good examples that I hope people take to heart. I want to be respectful of both of your time because we've been talking for an hour, and I so appreciate you sharing perspective and stories. So thank you both. Any last closing thoughts you have? And if you want to tell people where to find you online, if you want people to find you online, and if you don't, then don't worry about it.
I can be found at Keesh, KIESH, that's on Instagram and Twitter. You can find out about all my thoughts, opinions, and whatnot, and shenanigans there. I've also formed a company called The Corporate Doula, which focuses on practical career counseling for people of color, because I think it's really important for us to understand how to engage with our white counterparts now more than ever, and how to speak to them, not through anger and through that passion that we feel, but in a way that's productive, and just how to understand how you feel about some of the microaggressions you're experiencing and what to do about it in the right way.
You can find me on Twitter at jmalachi_bee. Malachi is MALAKAI, and that's _bravo echo echo. My timeline basically focuses on politics and social justice issues, so things that I'm passionate about. And if you follow me, you'll get some good commentary. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you both. Thank you. Thank you to everyone for listening. I hope that you got some perspective out of this episode today. You can find us online at thegriefcoach.co and on social at the_griefcoach. And thanks everyone for listening.